The Daily Buzz is made possible with support from Studio Movie Grill, opening hearts and minds one story at a time. A trip to SMG is unlike any other entertainment experience. Whether you come early or stay late, we'll set the mood for a great night to socialize and connect with an immersive movie-going experience. And independent filmmakers, you can four-wall your film or find a home at the many film festivals they host in their 30 locations across the country. And Onward, a search-driven brand experience agency. In today's heads-down society, people crave relevance, emotional connection, and honest information. Our pioneering search-first process delivers the credible insights for informed marketing communications.
The idea was to create a lab process where we could... There were a lot of new voices out there, but they were on the margin. The industry was pretty well controlled at that time by the studio system, and the studio system had a very strong edict of wanting to move towards profit. So their support of films usually had the idea, well, this has to be somewhere profitable. And I understand that. I was very much a part of that system. But I also could see and feel that there were other voices out there, and there were other stories to be told that were maybe more risky. They were more under this heading of independence, but they weren't being given a chance. So I thought, well, without harming the industry, maybe we could just add to it. So how to do that? How to create a mechanism where we could help these new voices get developed so they could at least get their stories told?
That was Robert Redford from the Sundance Film Festival opening press conference. You're listening to The Daily Buzz on kcpw.org, moviecitynews.com, and You Offend Me, You Offend My Family. This is day one. I'm John Wildman, and we are on location at Park City, Utah at the 2018 Sundance Film Festival. We're coming to you from Slam Dance headquarters on historic Main Street, interviewing some of the year's most important and exciting voices in the independent film world. Joining me this morning are my co-hosts Minji Chang and Lanzia Wan. Today, we're going to be talking about Hearts Beat Loud, Pick of the Litter, as well as a remembrance of the late Irene Cho, the Daily Buzz creator and longtime producer. And we're back on the Daily Buzz. My name is John Wildman. I'm here right now with a host of people, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves in a second, but this is a very special segment. Our longtime producer, the creator of this show, Irene Cho, we lost her in August of last year, and so we wanted to take a moment to talk about her and about what she meant to all of us and many people beyond it here. But really quickly, because we have a number of people around the table, and I would love for everybody to just introduce themselves really quickly. Minji.
Hi, my name is Minji Chang, and I'm the co-host of The Daily Buzz.
Hi, I am Kim Voyner, and I write for Movie City News, and I'm also a co-host of Daily Buzz.
Hi, I'm David Magdale. I am a publicist here, and I'm with David Magdale and Associates.
My name is Alicia Gustafson, and I'm also a publicist with David Magdale and Associates, and my first job was here as a PA on The Daily Buzz.
And I'm Lancia. I've helped Irene produced this show since its inception.
Okay. So, you know, this was a situation, this was a thing that nobody, you're never prepared for something like this to happen. But in this case, really, nobody was prepared for this. And everybody on who had worked on this show, as with every show, you know, people outside don't really understand what it takes to put on something like this. But in a case like this, Irene really lived and breathed this show, and she willed it into existence year after year after year. And while she was doing it, she was also doing a number of other things, sometimes working with David on PR as well. She was one of those people that juggled plates like they did on the old Ed Sullivan show. She constantly had a lot of things going. And she touched all of us. And Kim, why don't you start? Because we've talked about this quite a bit, and I would love for you to kind of talk about Irene for a moment.
Sure. We were talking last night when we were walking through the space about how all of us have known Irene pretty much from the beginning of our Sundance, and that was true. She's always been at Sundance for the 15 years that I've been coming here. The impression that Irene made the most on me in the last 4 years when I started working more closely with Daily Buzz, as you said, is how indefatigable she was about this show and how she literally willed it into existence year after year. We would never know. It would be December, and I'd be messaging going, Irene, what's going on with the show? Are we doing Daily Buzz? Is it happening? And she'd be like, I don't know. I'm working on it. I'm trying to raise money. Just, you know, give me a couple of weeks, Kim. You know how it always comes together. It always comes together. And I'd be like, okay, Irene, okay, I'm going to assume I'm going. And then like a week before, I get a call. Okay, I got the money. I don't have a lot, but I got it. And like year after year, she would pull it off. She would wrangle it into place. She would beg or borrow or bully or arm twist her way into finding some space to record. And once we had it, like everyone wanted to be on the show. Everyone wanted to know if Daily Buzz was happening. And that was because of Irene.
And David, I mean, you worked very closely with her and, you know, not on the show, but with your clients and on PR. And you had a very unique perspective of what it was like to be Irene's friend and to work with her.
Oh, you know, I met an Irene back in, 1991, 92. And the funny thing is, she and I were judges on a male beauty contest. It was Mr. Gay Asian or something like that. We met at somebody's house that had a swimming pool, and it was the bathing suit competition. And she and I hit it off really well. We kept making comments, and I thought, oh, I found a kindred spirit, because we were just making jokes about everything. And then we just, from that point on, it was like on. She was a journalist at the time working for an Asian American magazine, and that was back in 91 in Los Angeles. Fast forward to 2000, I had the opportunity to come up to Park City to work on a documentary called The Eyes of Tammy Faye. It was my maiden voyage. I had never been before, but HBO trusted that I would, you know, come up here. So I called her. I said, why don't you come with me? We'll come up and do this together. So for the two of us, that was our virgin experience coming into Park City and to Sundance. And it was baptism by fire.
Awesome.
So we had Tammy Faye Baker, RuPaul, and then we had World of Wonder. So we had three entities that were just working together on this. So We got 3 hours, 2 hours sleep, staying in the Yarrow Hotel. We had two twin beds and a cot that we all shared. And then we had tons of like MAC makeup and tons of like Diet Coke and Hershey's candy bars. Because we made this purse thing that was like a Sundance kit that had anything you would look into Tammy Faye's purse, you would get this like eyelashes and Coke. And anyway, that was our awesome. That was both of our virgin experience. And so from that point, we were hooked. And she found a way to stay involved with Sundance, not just through publicity. So she went to work for Sundance. She ended up living here in Park City, marrying here in Park City. You know, so she became a big entity. And as far as this show, this was always kind of a dream. Her commitment has always been to supporting filmmakers, especially Asian and Asian American filmmakers. So she had a hand with Korean filmmakers. 1 year she came in, after we did Eyes of Tammy Faye, she jumped on her own and did her own PR for, like, I think it was The Isle with, I forget the name of the Korean director, but she had those ties because that's who she was. And you guys all know this too. I mean, she was just that person that just made magic happen.
Well, and what I think was also wonderful, and I wrote about this, was the fact that she had a desire to do things in the way that I thought was the right way, which was to promote independent filmmakers, to really put Asian filmmakers front and center, foreign filmmakers on a show like this, because the inspiration oftentimes is to get whatever celebrities you can, you know, to be in front of the mic, because that's what people want to hear. But she really worked hard to go beyond that, and I appreciated that, and I think we were very kindred in that way.
I mean, because that was her platform, really, was independent film, you know, that, and also, you know, Asian American filmmakers as well. And I think that's the other thing about her spirit, was just really generous, and she was a hard worker. I mean, and she moved this show not only from Sundance or Park City, but we were at South by Southwest, yeah.
Cannes, Toronto.
Yeah. You went to Cannes with her, Alicia.
Yeah, I went to Cannes with Irene. I met Irene
At Nordstrom. I was working at Nordstrom, and they made joke, even at her funeral, they were joking, like, she's the type of person that made friends with everybody. She'd be best friends with a clerk at McDonald's. And everyone at her funeral was, like, arguing that they were Irene's best friend because she gave them that much love and attention to every person in her life that meant something to her, that when all these people started introducing themselves, they're like, oh, yeah, I'm Irene's best friend. They're like, wait, but I thought I was Irene's best friend. So there was this whole, like, battle of the, wait, so I guess, like, how did she have enough time to juggle, you know, 30 best friends, a husband, a son, and all these great projects supporting all these filmmakers? So Irene has just been one of the greatest mentors that I've ever had, and has just really been so supportive, you know, of females in film, of Asian American filmmakers and producers and projects. And so it's just been such a great experience to have known her and to be a part of the show. And she was my first introduction to Sundance and the film festival world. So, and she also introduced me to David, which is why I'm here today. So, yeah,
I'm really happy you said that, because it leads right into to Lanzi and Minji as far as being a mentor and being someone that kind of, like, you know, in a lot of ways, because these two, we wouldn't be here right now if it wasn't for Lanzia and Minji. So I would like for both of you to talk really quick, because we don't have a lot of time, but it's appropriate.
I met Irene. This is how I met Irene. And David, you mentioned that she kind of almost became like a local Park City person. And everyone in Park City knows her. I ran into someone from a completely different circle, and she knew her. And that's how I met her. It's because she's one of the only Asians living in Utah. And for some reason, we were walking through summer during Sundance, and I saw her, and she's like, hi, how are you? And I was like, good, where do I know you from? Like, that's how we knew each other. She got me involved with the press department at Sundance. And then I just kind of took on more of a, like, press-oriented, publicity-oriented sort of role, and that's how I met Minji as well, right?
Yeah, and meeting Lanzia last year was crazy, because the year before, Irene had invited me to moderate the Asian American Filmmakers Experience event that she also produced on top of the Daily Buzz, which I was like, just scratched the surface of all the different things Irene was into, and just kind of getting to peek into Irene's world opened the doors to so many different people, so many different relationships, so many different projects that were just mind-blowing. And I'll be forever grateful for that, because I wouldn't know or have experienced Sundance in the way that I did, met all of you guys, and to understand how much work goes into producing things like this and supporting filmmakers that, honestly, in my opinion, changed the world. And Irene changed the world through that.
Well, and also, too, I think with this particular show, with John, Kim, Anderson, everybody, she brought everybody together to do, it wasn't just her, you know, yeah. She brought everyone else in to also interview.
She was the ultimate collaborator.
Yeah, yeah. She was the ultimate collaborator, sure. And she knew who the right people to bring in and just really to talk about film and independence. You know, I know a lot of people are like, oh, I really feel sad she's not here. I feel her spirit, and I can still hear her in my ear yelling at me, like, why are you guys doing this show about me?
Having a filmmaker on in this spot.
We should have a filmmaker in this spot. You're wasting time. Come on, Minji, do this.
Yeah, exactly.
Come on,
yeah,
Minji. Pretty much.
Yeah, no, but this is great.
Well, and I wanted to wrap this up by repeating something that I wrote in the column that I wrote after she passed. And it goes for everyone in the room, so many people out here. But everyone may not realize it, but they all lost a major advocate.
Yep.
Maybe someone steps up. Maybe someone else takes the reins and pushes for the people that don't pal around with the bigs or have a major PR firm calling their shots or a film society wanting to soak in their glory. Maybe another person is out there that has the desire and the motor that Irene Cho did. And I'll tell you right now, they better hope so. And they should take a moment to respect what Irene Cho literally did for them. So, everybody, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you. This is great.
And you're listening to The Daily Buzz. My name is John Wildman. I'm here with my co-host, Minji Chang. We are now going to talk about the film Pick of the Litter. We have our directors here, Dana Nachman and Don Hardy. And I am it's shooting fish in the barrel for me with this film, you guys. And I'll explain in just a moment. But why don't you introduce our audience to your film? Tell us about it.
Sure. Pig of the Litter, it follows the one litter of puppies as they train to become guide dogs for the blind, and we're on this two-year odyssey with them to see which ones are good enough to make it all the way and which ones end up in maybe a different canine career or as the best pet you've ever had.
All of them would be the best pet you ever
yeah.
had.
Yeah, no doubt.
Well, and again, I am the target audience for this. My wife and I do dog rescues, and so watching this, of course, I'm agonizing with every dog and every single person who's taking care of every single dog. But I want to talk to you guys about how you went about making the film, because there's a structure here. It's almost like a you've structured it almost like a sporting event as far as who we're rooting for and do it. Can you talk about your decision and how to go about it that way?
Sure. We look at it as a competition film, and I think we've always wanted to make a competition film because it's so much fun. Spellbound is one of our favorite films, among others. Mm-hmm. Mad Hot Ballroom. It's such a nice narrative. It's easy to tell the story once it's set up that way. Mm-hmm. So it was, we started out at the birth, and then which ones would make the cut, and it was just 2 years of following them around. And, there's some nerve-wracking moments in that to see what if none of them make it. Like, that's not going to be a very great ending to our, so we really stressed about it. I mean, I was up some nights thinking about that. Or what if all of them made it? Then that's not that dramatic either, so.
I think it unfolded in a very compelling, fascinating way. And I think, you have puppies, and I'm not a dog owner, but I've owned several in the past, and you just get spellbound by their cuteness, but then also understanding the role that they play in being service dogs, and understanding that whole process was just absolutely fascinating for me to learn. Mm-hmm. And I'm just very curious, how did that come about, the subject, and how did you decide that this was the film that you wanted to make? What was your connection with these dogs and with this program?
Yeah, it's we were journalists at NBC in San Francisco when 15 years ago when we first found out about Guide Dogs for the Blind. We did some stories on them because they're based in Marin County, so it was right in our backyard. And we weren't off making documentaries yet, but we had this idea it'd be a great documentary to do something on them. Didn't really know how to do it, moved on to other projects. And then 3 years ago, when we were here with Dana's film, Bat Kid Begins, we got talking about the projects that got away. And the idea for this one came out of that. And the structure around it focusing on one litter of puppies seemed to make sense. And then we were off and filming.
Well, and it is wild because you find yourself watching, going, oh, come on, Phil, stay close to the curb. Stay close to the curb, Phil.
You could do it, Phil. Patriot.
Oh, come on, Phil guy.
I was a Phil guy.
Yeah, they're different camps. I'm a Patriot.
Team Phil.
Patriot was
that your favorite?
Yeah, he had such a great arc. I mean,
maybe Phil's the guy's guy, which is referenced in the film.
Yeah, so
maybe
guys
like even
Phil.
When he was named, right?
Yeah,
he's like, Phil's the guy that you.
Yeah,
Phil's your buddy.
Well, I love Poppet too, but there's a thing because, with all the dogs and Patriot, really so much where you go, you really are going, oh, please, please just hold it in just a little bit longer, and having a lot of dogs and doing that, you do get wrapped up in those personalities where you kind of do some transference and, thinking you can communicate in a different way. Can you talk about the access and, what the struggle with the access, if there were, the ease of the access in order to film it?
Well, we had interviewed several different service dog organizations, and we chose Guide Dog for the Blind because they had a big infrastructure in place, because we knew that us coming in is a big deal. We were going to shoot over 2 years. We didn't know how many dogs there would be, but we thought there would be between 4 and maybe 9 dogs. Thank God there were not 9 dogs. But it was perfect with what we had, 5 dogs. So we wanted a place that could handle us, because there's a lot of people. It's a dog movie, but there's tons of people that went into training these dogs, tons of people, then the blind handlers who got them at the end. So we had to have, people vetted. We had to have different kinds of people in the film. And so Guide Dogs for the Blind not only is a great organization, but had the infrastructure to help us do this. It was difficult.
Yeah, and I think there was a lot of trust along the way. They don't let people in like this very often. And so they opened up the doors to us and gave us a lot of freedom within that the support we really needed. So,
and I think there's also, there's all these beautiful layers besides obviously learning the dogs and rooting for them and seeing their growth and their training, but also understanding everybody involved in making this program work, including the initial trainers before they go to the person that they're going to be the guide dog for, these interim owners that my heart just broke for, because you know they're there for a certain amount of time and they're working with them, and I got teary a couple of times.
I did too. It got me. You guys got me.
We try. Some people say they cry in the open. And so we're like, okay, if we got you at hello, then we're pretty good.
Yeah.
But those puppy raises that you mean, they take the dogs for the first 14 months of their lives, and they give them all those basic skills, and then they have to give them back. And that is really hard. And I don't think any dog owner could give away their dog like that. But they know that it's part of the deal, that they're temporary, but it's still very hard.
Well, as someone who fosters, it is where you're very happy, when like a dog finds its family and everything, but you just love them to death at the same time. So we don't have a lot of time, but I really want you to also address how you approached the blind subjects, because there was a learning aspect with that I thought was really great.
I think one of the best parts of this is that, I hadn't experienced a lot of blind people in my life personally. And so we were able to really talk to them, and in realizing that a lot of people shy away from blind people because, they see a cane and you just want to get out of their way because it's hard. So they can be isolated. So I think that the dogs give them not only this independence, but gives them a pal, and it's very, people come up to them all the time. And so I thought it was really fun to be able to get to know them, tell their stories. They were so eager for people to tell their stories. And so I hope that the film, and I think it seems to resonate with people from a people level as much as a dog level. And so the blind handlers are awesome, and I think we consider them friends now for sure.
I can understand. Well, again, we've been talking with Dana Ackman and Don Hardy, the directors of Pick of the Litter, their latest documentary, which is screening at Slamdance. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, we are back on the Daily Buzz. My name is John Wildman. I'm here with my co-host, Minji Chang. And right now we're going to talk about Hearts Beat Loud, which is a Sundance premiere. We have the director, Brett Haley. We also have Nick Offerman and Kiersey Clemens here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey. Let's buzz it up.
Brett, we're going to start off with Brett, who's 3 for 3 now on Sundance and festival favorites, following I'll See You in My Dreams and The Hero. I've had him on my red carpet at Dallas with The Hero. And so, Brett, you start us off. You tell us what this movie is about.
Well, it's about a father and a daughter, played by Nick and Kiersey, who in the last summer before Kiersey's character Sam heads off to college, Nick convinces her, his character convinces her to turn their sort of weekly jam sesh into an actual band, and they record a song called Hearts Beat Loud, and the fun begins there. It's really about the love between a father and a daughter, and letting go and dreams, sort of having certain expectations of what you thought your life was going to be and what the reality is. But at the end of the day, it's a really sweet, heartwarming, honest movie about a father and a daughter playing some music together.
So in this Partridge Family, Nick is Shirley Jones and Kiersey is David Cassidy.
Is that what's going on? That works. Yeah. And I do want to say I'm actually 3 for 4. The first movie I ever made, and I want everybody out there to know, there's been a lot of failure along my route, which is important. It makes you better. But my first movie did not get into the Sundance Film Festival.
See, I just know about the successes, Brett.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Right. Nobody knows about the bumpy parts. Yeah.
Well, speaking of dreams coming true, though, we were hearing the story about how you wanted to make a musical and how that was a dream of yours as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And I just think that it's so fabulous. And how did that come to fruition?
He heard me singing in the hair and makeup trailer when we were working on The Hero. And I think
done deal.
He entered a sort of Brigadoon reverie. and said, I'm picturing you with a daughter who sings like she's related to Whitney Houston somewhere in Brooklyn. And here we are.
And here we are.
Yeah, that's exactly how
it works. I do love musicals, though. And I wanted to make, I think, what I think this is it's not a musical, but it's a grounded music-driven film. There are four original songs in the film by Keegan DeWitt. And Nick and Kiersey sing all of the songs live in the movie. And Kiersey really carries the weight of that. She's they just saw the movie last night for the first time, by the way. So they're
How'd
all
that go?
I don't know. How did it go?
How was it seeing it?
I cried. I never cry watching movies, which is funny because Brett, that's his goal, is to make everyone cry. I cried.
In a good way.
I was really, yeah. I was really happy. No, it was a good cry. It was warm. And I was saying how, especially because I was like playing younger, I just kind of got lost in watching myself for the first time ever because I felt so detached from like Sam. And it felt like, oh, wow, I am watching this. This is like a, not me. It's like a reflection of a person like me that I want to watch on screen. And watching Sasha felt the exact same way. So it was really nice. I was really emotional.
Brett, talk about the challenges of filming music, live music. Talk about that as a director.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and Nick and Kiersey should talk to this as well. You know, they had to go through sort of band boot camp, if you will, and learn how to play these instruments, learn how the music worked. Nick had to really bone up on his bass and guitar skills, and which he already was great, but, you know, these were outside, I think, of his comfort zone. So they really had to work hard, and Kiersey and Nick did all of their vocals pretty much on the spot live in the day. So on a very short schedule, it was a challenge. It was a challenge for all of us. It was like there's a big sequence in the film, and we shot it five nights in a row. Every night we shot a piece of it, of this big, you know, musical sequence. And so it was really these guys like coming up and having the stamina, and Kiersey having to do like, you know, I don't know how many takes we did, but like 10 takes where she just had to wail every single time. Nick had to do a whole song where he played acoustic guitar and sing, and we did probably 6 or 7 takes of that. I mean, it's tough on them, and I give them all the credit for really stepping up and making it happen, because it's not easy. It's very complicated, and they're literally, Kiersey would be in front of like 30 extras singing a cappella, because she's hearing the music in an earwig with a tiny device in her ear. No one else can hear it. So she's just literally totally exposed singing, and everyone is like listening to her. There's no music backing, nothing. So it was a challenge, but it was a lot of, it was fun though. It was a good challenge.
Well, and as actors, you know, listen, you know, there's a certain pressure that comes with just doing scenes and doing lines. There's a whole nother level when you're singing, when you're performing music. I would really love for both of you to kind of talk about that layered on top of just simply putting a character together.
I think it feels really, well, for me, it feels really dorky. Like the doing the thing where everyone's like dancing, but not knowing what I'm singing to, and I'm singing a cappella, or sometimes I would be lip syncing while they're doing their like, woos. It was just, there's all this awkward stuff where you can tell that everyone's looking like, she looks so ridiculous right now. So it's a little bit it's a lot of it out of my comfort zone. But then that makes the challenges that come from acting like nothing.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it relieves the pressure a little bit.
It does. Yeah. It helps. Yeah.
And Nick, you kind of have it.
Acting is embarrassing to begin with.
Terrible.
Very true.
Add some white guy dance moves.
Do you have an extensive musical background, Nick?
I love music. I mean, I've done musicals. I'm not known for my pipes. I'm known for my dancing. But I love musicals and music. I play music, but I usually depend on making people laugh with my music, and then they don't care about my musicianship. So it was a great education. The main difficulty was learning to play some riffs on the electric guitar. I play acoustic mainly, and so it's funny if you see the film. What I'm doing looks pretty simple to look at, but inside me, I'm like Joe Satriani. my fingers feel like they're on fire. I'm ripping such an
over and over
incredible
and over again.
Guitar
yeah,
solo.
Over and over. I mean, literally, Nick would have to do crazy guitar stuff, you know, 20 times in a night. And his, I think your wrist hurt quite a bit a few times.
Well, sure. I mean, but I'm a good mule.
Yeah.
Occupational hazard.
Yeah, it was stuff. it was all worth it.
So the carpal tunnel was worth it in this, yeah. in this case.
I hope so.
Well, again, the title of film is Hearts Beat Loud. It is a Sundance premiere, and we've had with us Brett Haley, Nick Offerman, and Kiersey. Thank you for both being here, for
thanks
all being
you
here.
Guys.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
And we're wrapping up day one of the Daily Buzz on kcpw.org, moviecitynews.com, and You Offend Me, You Offend My Family. This show is made possible with the support of KCPW and Slamdance Film Festival. Our sponsors, Studio Movie Grill, which is opening hearts and minds one story at a time, and Onward. Additional support is provided by Movie City News, The Market in Park City, Ruby Snap, and City Cakes. Our producer is Lanzia Wan. Tune into the Daily Buzz. On our next show, we'll talk to Salt Lake City Weekly's Scott Renshaw, as well as filmmakers from the Sundance films Anote's Ark and White Rabbit.